Okay.
Room service. I'm sitting on the bathroom floor, leaning back against the sink. The bathtub is between me and the wall. The bathtub will stop a certain kind of bullet, not all kinds, but it's the best that I can do. I called room service, double vodka and some peanuts. Maybe I could do without the peanuts, but I've got to see what's going on. I may be alive after this room service, or maybe not. The bathroom door is open so I can see where the guy has to put the tray. The door to the hotel room is slightly ajar. I hear room service very softly. I say, come in, I'll be right out. I figured all the places in the hotel room. This is it, the bathroom. He comes in, the tray balanced on both hands, but the left hand is holding the tray. The right hand is underneath, covered by a napkin. I was right. Now I know, I say, over here. He can't turn quickly because of the tray, because the right hand, but the right hand is looking for me, so to speak. My gun is buried in a hotel pillow to muffle the noise. I shoot him, pop, more or less, in the head. I don't want a lot of blood around. And where did I get the gun? Somebody thoughtfully left it in the drawer next to the bed while I was out. Now I've got a dead guy in the room and another gun. Not that it will do me any good if the bozos are coming next. Big moment, waiting for the bozos. Nobody comes. It was a solo job. Of course, the room service will be looking for him soon, so I drag him out to the carp pond near the wooden walkway, then into the pond with a heavy chair tied to him with a bunch of room service napkins. He'll never miss them, and the blood will keep the carp churning and muddy up the pond until I can get him out. The pond is surrounded by tropical fronds and stuff, and I doubt that many of the hotel guests give it much attention when they're going between the hotel cottages and the entrance where there's the breakfast room and the bar. If they don't find him, I'll take care of it later. What's going on? I left home about 3 weeks ago for a well-planned tour of some countries in Southeast Asia. I'm with my wife and some friends from her yoga group. I have an assignment, of course. I can't leave home anymore without an assignment. Can't even take a vacation. Why did I endanger my wife and her yoga friends? Because this one didn't seem so bad. They're all bad, I guess, if you haven't done it before, but I thought I could pull this one off without my wife and a bunch of innocent people getting killed. Run-of-the-mill stuff, no problem. So why am I trying to not get shot? The company I've been keeping. What else? I'm waiting. Nothing happened for the whole 3 weeks. Well, almost nothing, and I did it as I was told, so it looked like I was home free. Fat chance, but I did get my wife and the yoga group home, unless the plane is fixed to blow up. And now I'm back to where I started, almost. I've got a dead guy in the carp pond and not the slightest idea of what's going to happen next. I left this very room this morning with everything packed in the carry-on. Luggage can be an inconvenience in my line of work. Now I don't have the carry-on, but that's later. I'm back, and my clothes are where they were yesterday, except they're not the clothes I brought. They're exact imitations. God, they even know what kind of underwear I wear. Those guys in the company are thorough, even if they are sort of careless sometimes about things like my wife. Now the floor is covered with peanuts and the vodka is spilled. It's hard to put the vodka and the peanuts down properly when you've got a bullet in you, and there's no mini bar. This is deep trouble. So I sit on the bed, the gun in my hand. Whatever is going to happen should happen. Pretty soon the phone rings. This should be room service, asking if what I ordered was up to my expectations, and where's the guy that brought it? I answer, yeah. The voice says, ah, monsieur le professeur, I heard you are in this beautiful country, and I would like to introduce you to some of the local cuisine. I know the voice. It's one of the recent reasons I'm still alive, but no names over this phone. Perhaps we could meet in a half hour. I'm having my car washed in a station behind your hotel if you came out the way you came in. He means the back door past the kitchen and the servants' toilets. Turn left and you will see me at the end of the block. He means the end of the alley. After I have cleaned up the room as best I can, I dress for a night of local cuisine and head for the back door. The tour. This is the last one. I'm getting too old for this, but this one should be easy. My wife's yoga class has a guy from somewhere in the scraps of Pennsylvania who told me that when he was a kid, he had two dreams. One, get out of town. Two, go to places where people don't look like him. I think he probably saw copies of National Geographic when he was a kid with the women who don't wear bras and the guys with bones through their noses. That's the way it happened for me. So now he does this when he's not teaching yoga. He gets a few people together and you go someplace you would never go by yourself. My wife went with him a couple of years ago. She came back raving about how wonderful the rest of the world is. That didn't sound right to me, but the yoga tour should make this job easier. Usually I have to live with some unbelievable reason to go places like, say, the one I'm in now. The company says they've got you covered, but as they say in the mystery stories, those guys don't know from real. They sit behind desks in Washington and make up these stories, totally unbelievable. So when I get there, there's always a couple of guys following me around or sitting at the next table in the restaurant. Guys you don't want to meet in the alley, but I decided to go on this one because it fit in with the job. The bozos know I'm there, but what they don't know is what I'm supposed to be up to, and they want to know, so they're always there, like in the mystery stories. Only the mystery stories make it look easy. In the mystery stories, the traveler is a tough guy in sheep's clothing. He can always take the two guys somehow when things get rough. But Jesus, I'm an old man, and I wasn't even tough before. I'm a piece of cake to these guys, but it's a job, you know, and I've been doing it for a long time, ever since the company figured out I have to go a lot of places because of what I do for a living. They came to me with some leverage I couldn't do anything about, something about my family and the dangers they are in, so I had to start doing it. Actually, now I don't think my family is in danger except from the guys I am working for. They picked me out from some customs list because I go a lot of places. I think I'm the one that's in danger. That's later too. I don't need to tell you what I do for the company. It's not a big deal, actually. I don't kill people or arrange to have people killed. I'm sort of the messenger, I guess. I go to some place like the market or looking at the local crafts. I run into somebody I've never seen before. He says the right thing. I say the right thing. He says the right thing. And a couple of nights later, we run into each other accidentally, someplace out of the way. Jesus, where are the bozos? He gives me something, and I get back to the hotel as fast as I can. Then the room service comes with a package for me, like my laundry, and they leave with the package I've put together, which goes out with the room service, dinner tray buried in napkins, and that's it? Easy, huh? The watch. This one should be easy. Deliver a watch. Can you believe it? I've done the watch thing before. Before I leave, I always have to meet with some guy at a restaurant or in some park. Same routine, different details. When you get to this town, go to a store that sells cheap watches. I memorize the address. The taxi will know. All tourists buy cheap watches to take back to their relatives at home. Shop for a watch or two. Keep trying them on. Try one. Try a different one. Take a lot of time. Try on a bunch of watches. It's hard to make up your mind. The guy selling the watches says the right thing. You say the right thing. He says the right thing. You make up your mind. Buy three watches, but you got one of the new ones on your wrist. You forgot the watch you brought with you. What could be easier? I don't wear a watch to meet the guy at Midtown. Leave the Timex at home. I got a new watch coming. Very nice. Not a Rolex. Some brand I've never seen before. I don't know much about watches. The new watch has three dials in addition to telling the time. When I get home, I'll have to put on my glasses to see what the three dials mean. Just in case, the new watch seems just a little thick, a 16th of an inch. Otherwise, flawless, good looking, not too fancy for a person like myself, a gift from the company when I retired. But I never had a company except the company I work for like now, and that's just what I call it. And they don't give you a watch because you don't retire. For this watch, you set it to a certain time. Say, the wearer's birthday. One dial is the year, another is the month, the third is the day. So you can go to an astrologer and find out when you are going to get killed or need a new watch. Like one day you're strolling down the street in, say, Vienna or Miami Beach, waiting for the light, and you feel that certain something in your ribs. The guy says, give me the watch, no problem. You're out of the game for a while until you get a new watch. Of course, they can get this stuff out of you and torture. Torture has its ways nobody holds up. And that's why they have cells. You only know three or four guys. Torture can't make you tell what you don't know, but what you do know keeps changing all the time, and you find out about the new rules by looking for something in a shop window or in the newspaper, anything, something in the personals. Maybe the rule is if you and the watch are separated by 25 feet for 10 minutes, the satellite keeping track of you because of the little thing implanted in your head and keeping track of the watch shuts the system down and you are out of it even if you give in to torture. Where was I? Oh, yeah. You set the watch to 12 o'clock, push the screw halfway back in. The three dials go to certain numbers, and those numbers are the password code. Go to an internet cafe, hope the cafe is untrustful. Pull up, say, porno or toy trains or antique cards. You need a passport. You got it off the watch. There's a guy on the other end, and he can tell you stuff you don't want to know, but you have to know. Set the watch to the real date. It's just a watch. Those guys are very clever. The watches come in all styles, depending on who you're supposed to be, a rich banker, a woman of a certain elegance, a mountain climber, an astronomer. We got them in all styles. Timex, Patek Philippe, you name it, this one is made for a man of my circumstances, but the new watch seems just a little too thick. Probably there's a chip in there. Put it in some computer, it disrupts all air traffic for 500 miles around. Maybe it's got the name and address of every spy in the world. I don't care. All I've got to do is wear it and forget it when I go shopping, and I've got to remember how it works. Not so simple. I did the watch thing a couple of times before. The company is into watches. Maybe the boss's brother-in-law sells watches. Never pass up a chance to make a buck. There was the trip I got credit on my conscience for something happening to somebody I didn't even know. I had the watch. I called room service. Vodka and a bowl of peanuts. Finished the vodka. Room service again. Another vodka. No more peanuts. The room service man came, took away the napkins, stuff from the last call. The watch was in the napkins as instructed. After an hour or so, I called for another vodka. A different man brought it. Where's the other guy? I always tip when I'm finished. I'm a big tipper. He's gone home. I got the idea he wasn't exactly telling me the truth. Next time I ran into my neighbor by accident in a bar, I sort of picked up the last minute strolling through the city, looking at the sights. I asked him, what happened to the room service man? He hasn't been seen since he left your room. My neighbor was really unhappy, like I had screwed up. I was unhappy too, because I knew the room service man would never be seen again, and it's been on my conscience ever since. I did just as I was told, got the instructions straight, but now there's somebody who will never be seen again, wife and kids, mother and father, who will wonder forever what happened to him, but only a half a credit on my conscience for this one. I did as I was told. They screw up, those guys who make the plans. It's not always as easy as I made out, of course, because if I understand it, it's a 3 or 4-way game, and I don't even know who all the players are. I mean, the two guys sitting at the next table in the restaurant, they don't have to be on either team. They could be in Chinese employ, even if we're a long way from China. Maybe they're not looking for me. They're looking for the guy I have to meet. He says the right words. I say the right words. They pick him up later and take him to some place for a little talk, which includes a lot of things I don't want to think about and things I couldn't tell you if I knew. I had it happen once for me, but that was a different place. Not so bad as here from what I've heard. And I was younger then, but it's no fun, not something you want to have happen often. When you come out, you don't look like you used to look, and you don't feel like having dinner that night. You don't feel like having dinner for a week or two. If you can get back to the hotel, which can be a problem, depending on how you look and how well you can walk, you tell the clerk you got hit by a taxi and you reported it to the police and everything's okay. The clerk looks at you and knows you didn't get hit by a taxi. Maybe he should call the police, but he knows that if he calls the police, things might not go so well for him for a while, so he doesn't call the police. He takes a room service order for a bottle of something strong, vodka if they have it. You get the bottle and a dish of peanuts and a hole up for a few days waiting for the parts to start working again. And in addition to taking care of yourself, you have to try to take care of the guy who said the right words. He's probably on the home team. Maybe also take care of the hotel clerk and the guy that brings the room service. Assume that everybody works for somebody. Also the guy getting whacked around in the interrogation room, in the gray building talks, in the interrogation room everybody talks. Who can blame them? I give myself points every time somebody gets killed. When the points add up to a certain number that I haven't figured out yet, I'm getting out. They're not going to hurt my family just because I'm too old and can't take it anymore. They'll just pop me so I don't get drunk in a bar and shoot off my mouth. I'm counting off the points. The room service guy, that's a full point. I get a half a point when I do what I'm told and somebody else gets killed. They're adding up. This should be the last one. When I get home, I'm going to tell the boss that I want out. I'm getting tired of people going into the interrogation room in the gray building just because I made a mistake. The company. I went to the boss after the last one. I'm getting out. That didn't cut it. The guy sitting at the desk, nice suit, nice tie, silk, with a rolled collar made in Thailand. He reminded me of a leverage and smiled. I want to reach across the desk and adjust his tie so he can't breathe, but that's a dream. If I make a move, 3 guys appear and remind me of my role in things as they are. So I just sit there thinking about the room service guy who was probably on vacation for a long time, I'm in for sure. When I can't do it anymore, then I'll never get another call. But you never know. This one looked easy. I wasn't going on some unbelievable excuse all by myself. I'm with my wife's yoga group. It's a cover of a sort, and I'm sorry. I don't do yoga. I'm too old. The teacher has to make up special things for me to do while the other people are standing on their head and things. Very friendly, and the teacher who organizes things is a wonderful guy. Yoga in the morning, then breakfast. Go out to the van. Go out, get on the van to some temple. We're out all day, back late in the afternoon. Everybody's tired, so the afternoon yoga is easy. Stretches and ways of relaxing the body after a long day of looking at temples and going to where local people make things like pots and weaving. So I can do the afternoon class. That gives me some cover if one of the guys at the hotel is on the other team. Also, I can go on my own passport. I don't have to be some guy from Cleveland to import-export, you know, with a bunch of phony papers which may or may not hold up if the other team knows I'm coming. I'm just an old guy who can't do yoga very well, but he's trying. I went on one with the yoga group a couple of years ago. I didn't get an assignment. I went like a normal human being, but this one was not different. According to the life I lead, a couple of weeks before we left, I got the phone call in the middle of everything else that I was doing, which already had me stretched out beyond my limits. I had to go to some restaurant in Midtown and meet with this creep who gave me a package of instructions, what to expect, what the words are, what the guy I'm looking for might look like, where he might be, and of course what I'm supposed to tell him if we get together. I have to memorize this stuff. I'm really stressed out. I'm too old for this, but they've got on me what they've got on me, and I have to keep doing it or something bad will happen to somebody. So we're there for 3 weeks and nothing is happening. I don't see the usual two bozos lurking around. I go to the temple and things with the yoga group. I'm beginning to have fun. I'm doing yoga in the evenings on the terrace of the hotel while the sun is setting. But something is wrong. It's supposed to happen and it hasn't happened, and tomorrow we are supposed to go home. Mr. Bigheart is very real. He's close to being morally perfect, too. I doubt that he's invincible, but he's still around, and he's been through a lot of things I wouldn't want to go through. So I'm in this exotic place. I've been here for 3 weeks, and nothing has happened, and I'm supposed to be going home tomorrow. This is very ominous. If I were alone, I would just hunker down in the hotel and live on room service, but I'm not alone. My wife is with me. We're still in that part of the story where my wife and her yoga friends haven't gone home yet. The part where I am in the bathroom waiting for the room service comes later in the story, except I've already told you. I get all mixed up. Something is going to happen. The question is, what? This afternoon, we were at the swimming pool. I've got the gun under the towel. I can get away with this because I can't swim. There are people around getting a tan, so I demonstrate that I can't swim. There's always got to be a cover. And what do you know? Mr. Bigheart appears at the pool. He invites us to go to a famous shrine that evening, one that we haven't been to yet. How does he know? He'll pick us up around 6. Sounds like fun. At 6 sharp, this splendid van, courtesy of someone, appears with Mr. Bigheart and the driver. We go to the country to visit the shrine. The park is closed because the sun is setting, but Mr. Bigheart knows the guard or something. We go through without any passes or ID. We go a mile or so to a shrine that was built 800 or 900 years ago to honor some animal. Across from the shrine is a bunch of tables and chairs under umbrellas where a family sells souvenirs and soft drinks. to the tourists during the day. Everything else is closed, but they're still open. Must be waiting for us. They greet Mr. Bighart like he is the ambassador from heaven. We are introduced. There are a lot of hugs. My wife notices that the family's teenage daughter speaks almost perfect English. She says later that probably Mr. Bighart is putting the girl through school on his own money. After a soft drink and a little talk, we go to visit the shrine. It is, curiously, a maze. Who thought of that idea? I have trouble with directions anyway, so mazes are a nightmare for me. I need that legendary string. After we look at the setting sun from the top level, everybody starts exploring on their own. I am wandering around. The walls are about 15 feet high, covered with carvings of the animals and dragons and hieroglyphs that nobody can read yet. This is a maze, remember, and at some point I turn a corner and see a dead end. Mazes, Jesus, who thought up this idea? But I keep looking at the walls and wondering if there's some hidden way out of the dead end. Nope, so I turn around to go back, and guess what? There are the two guys I've been waiting for 3 weeks. They've really got me this time. The walls are 15 feet high. I decided back at the hotel not to bring my equipment so as to make the tour more casual. Not that the equipment would be useful now. They've got the drop on me in that phrase they use in old movies, and they definitely have their equipment. Big mistake on my part. They are walking toward me very slowly to scare me, I suppose, as if I could be more scared. This is going to be one of those not so much fun moments. Oh well, you can't live forever. Even with all the charm I've been told I have, these guys are not into charm. This is it, I say to myself. Nice going, tourist. Then, amazingly, I see, about 15 feet behind them, Mr. Bighart. He appears from nowhere. I've learned not to give this away with my eyes. It's part of the training. I'm looking at them with a big smile. They are looking at me, then pop, pop, somewhere. Two widows have started living on their pensions. I am not surprised that Mr. Bighart is a good shot. Just two. Pop, pop, he says. Let's get out of here. I'll fix it later. The park is closed. Nobody's going to be around. I offer to help. It's only fair since I'm the one that's still alive. But the sun is almost gone, and my wife is back under the umbrellas, and everybody is having a fine time. We say goodbye, lots of hugs. I have the feeling I'll never see these wonderful people again. Mr. Bighart explains that at night the family goes home, but the man stays, folds up the umbrellas, and protects the stuff from wandering thieves. I suppose he will help Mr. Bighart find a hole somewhere nearby, cover the bozos, and the animals will take care of the rest. So tonight is rather uneasy. If the bozos were supposed to report that they had what they wanted from me and they didn't report on time, then there'll be somebody waiting at the airport and my passport will be the giveaway. I will not be leaving. I'm not worried now about my leaving. I'm worried about my wife and the innocent people in the yoga group. If I don't go through, nobody goes through. Everybody goes to the interrogation room in the Gray Building and answers a few questions. Nobody will know what the questions are about, which makes them look like liars to the boys who are asking the questions. This is going to be a mess. Why did I do this? So the night at the hotel is unusually tense. My wife keeps asking me why I'm not in bed sleeping. I say that my stomach is upset, which it is, and I keep going to the toilet to pretend that I'm not well. We're packed. Now we just have to go to the airport the next morning and do the ordinary thing, which is going to work or not work, depending on the timing with whoever is waiting for the bozos to call in. Boy, I hope they're Chinese. We are a long way from China, and communications could be slow. Naturally, the next morning I opt out of breakfast. I've already found a spot where I can see the breakfast room without being seen. It seems like everything is okay. The yogis are laughing and talking. I don't see any other bozos around. We might make it. The airport. When we get to the airport, things go as usual. Nobody jumps out of the crowd with a gun on me. Now it's just passports that check in. Just as we are about to get to the passport window, there is a huge ruckus at the other end of the room. Two guys are fighting and everybody around them is yelling and all of the police are moving in that direction. This is a real break, but there's something screwy about it. It looks like one of those action theater pieces from the 1960s. Then I glance out the door and see Mr. Big Heart moving away in a taxi, and I get it. This is what I call hell. We go through the passport line quickly because the passport guys are distracted by the ruckus. We're in. We go to the gate and get there just as the first call comes. I jump on the first bus and get to the plane without being shot. I smile nicely at the flight attendants, find my seat and cover my face with a newspaper to show that the old man is really tired and needs some sleep. Actually, I need some sleep, but I don't think I'm going to get it until we get to cruising level. I can't believe it. We got away. I forgot to add that when we were doing that little history of the tour, I fell in love. Actually, I fell in love twice. We went to two places. I fell in love once in each place. The country is a police state. It's funny about police states. You never see the police like at home, because the guys who own the police are so thoroughly in power that they don't need to remind the citizens that everything is in control. The citizens know it. They know it from experience. They know it because a brother or a cousin went down into the interrogation room with the big guys, and if he got out, he explained to everybody what they shouldn't do or should do, and word got around. The moral is, when you stop seeing the police, you know you're in trouble. Otherwise, they're just around, but they're just troublesome. I mean, like at home, working on the poor people to remind them that they are poor, working on the rich people with traffic tickets and little things to remind them that everything is in control. Remember that next time you get a traffic ticket. Everything is in control. I'll start with the second falling in love. The first one is more complicated, and you may be impatient by that time and leave. The second one was a man who told me he was 33 years old. I'll call him Soapy. Maybe that will save his life. We were having tea. Actually, I was having vodka to settle my stomach. Whatever bad you say about alcohol, it settles your stomach. And sometimes that is more important than being sober in a place where the toilets, if there are any toilets, are hard to find and involve squatting and wondering if your pants are out of the way. So he was having tea and I was having vodka in case we were going to visit another shrine. I give him the name Soapy because if some creep who works for his government should happen to hear this, God forbid, he would get in trouble. He might get killed. I don't know what they do now to people who think this man thought about a lot of things, so they would probably just kill him if they found out when he was a kid the government started killing people. The boss of the country thought Mao's idea of killing everybody over 15 would put him in complete control. Also, if it was known that you knew anything at all or spoke a few words of another language, You were a goner. So Soapy's father and mother had moved from the north, where the boss was really in control, to the south, where it was a little safer, and hid out with the father's sister for 7 years. The man I'm talking to was 3 years old then. They killed his brother. He said his father had seen so much suffering, he didn't believe in anything anymore. Soapy asked me if I believed in anything. I said, no. He said, are you a Christian? I said, no. He said, if you don't believe in anything, you must be a Buddhist. I said, how can I be a Buddhist with all these Buddha statues around? He said, my father would really like you. That was the second arrow in my heart. The first arrow in my heart came when I fell in love the first time. The first time was earlier, and we were in a different part of the country. Now I'm going to introduce Pooh. There are only two things I should say to introduce her. I mean, say about her, apart from what I, from what's not here. One thing, some tourist left a case of country music records behind, and she's played them all and memorized them. Like, we could play that one sample now.
Crazy, I'm crazy for feeling so lonely.
So if you could just imagine that music through the rest of this, which is not too long. The second thing is that another tourist left a carry-on full of mystery stories. And Pooh has read all the mystery stories, and she recognizes it. In every mystery story, there are two or three places where there's just two lines of dialogue. One guy says something, the other guy says something. And the piece turns around at that place. Very, very nice. So, just to give you an example of this, now's the time for me to introduce you to Joe Pike. Joe Pike is a character in the imagination of Mr. Robert Crase, a great mystery writer. Here's a short introduction to Joe Pike. This is from Free Fall by Robert Crase, page 88, if you want to check it out. Joe Pike works with the private investigator, Elvis Cole. Joe Pike went through a very brutal childhood. Since then, he has put himself through all kinds of toughening to make sure the punishment and the pain never happen again. As a result, he is practically indestructible and has a magic quality of appearing as if from nowhere to do a lot of damage to the bad guys. He is righteous in every moral way. The world is black and white. He has a great sense of humor, which he conceals behind black glasses and a barely moving face. This is a story about the Los Angeles Police Department Task Force Against Drugs. The task force, unfortunately, is in cahoots with a dope gang in LA because the leader of the gang set up the task force to be videotaped killing an unarmed black man in a store. The task force is being blackmailed to take out a rival gang. Elvis Cole, the private investigator, has stumbled on this arrangement. He makes a phone call to Joe Pike. In this excerpt, the two guys in the car mentioned in the next paragraph are members of the task force, and they are protecting themselves. This is Elvis Cole. It's me. I'm standing in the 7-Eleven parking lot on San Pedro, about three blocks south of Martin Luther King Boulevard. I'm with a black guy in his early 20s named James Edward Washington, a white guy, an Hispanic guy in a dark blue 1989 sedan are following us. I think they've been following me for the past 2 days. Joe Pike says, "Well, shoot them." Elvis Cole remarks, "Life is simple for some of us." And the only reason I read that is because I was thinking that it would be nice to have some music that was just based on, "Well, shoot them. Life is simple for some of us." Poof. I'm an old man and I don't flirt with women who are young enough to be my granddaughter, but in this case there was something about poo, another name I made up to protect the innocent, I wanted to get to. I couldn't put my finger on what it was, but I wanted to find out. I wanted to know. So I just kept being nice and looking at her, and sometimes I'd catch her looking at me, and I thought, this is going just right. We are making friends even with all of these other people around all the time, and she doesn't care. She wants to talk to me, and I want to talk to her. This goes on for about a week. Then one day, the whole party is on a boat, a kind of small cruise ship. We're on the boat for 3 days, so everybody spends a lot of time together on the deck, getting some sun and reading, or just looking at what's going by on the shore. We are way out in the middle of nowhere by my standards. I don't read on the deck. I just watch the shore or get a drink and sit at the table in the shade in the middle of the deck doing nothing. Then one time she comes to the table and sits across from me, and we start talking. This is what I've been waiting for. Maybe she's going to sit down and say, "Okay, this is what you want to know." No, that's too American. She would never do that. She just sits down almost like she is assigned to make all the tourists happy. And now it's my turn. She's all bundled up because it's winter here. She's got all kinds of sweaters on and a shawl over her shoulders. The Americans are sitting around in t-shirts and shorts, and she's all bundled up. This is exciting in itself. She's so different, and that's what I want to know about also. She wears a smear of some kind of light-colored paste on each cheek. I don't know what the paste is made of, and she doesn't wear it all the time, but when she does wear it, it's very mysterious and very attractive, like the way some African women get marked by scars. When I was a kid working at the library information desk, I looked up one day and saw an African princess who wanted some information. Her face was completely covered by scars. They were beautifully drawn. I almost fainted by falling in love so fast. But this woman wears a smear of light colored paste on each cheek. It's not a spot like the rouge that some European women wear. It's like she put her fingers in a bowl of paste and then just wiped her fingers on both sides of her cheeks for about 2 inches, starting from each side of her nose. I asked her why she did it. She said it was a sign that she was white. Actually, she looked white to me, sort of olive-colored like people who live near the Mediterranean, but definitely white. She said that in her country, white was very important, but that the people in her tribe, whatever that means, were darker than was acceptable. So it was a custom to put the smear of light-colored paste on the woman's face to make her look white. Jesus, humans are nuts. Actually, it was very beautiful. I couldn't take my eyes off her. I've forgotten how we started. I think the waiter, who's a deckhand too, and who probably catches on more than I think he does, comes around and asks us if we want a drink. I've already got one. And I'm trying to be careful because it's only the middle of the afternoon and I've already had a couple, which my wife has noticed, probably other people too. I don't care about the other people. I only care about my wife because I don't want to embarrass her by being a drunk. Not a drunk, I don't get drunk. I mean a heavy drinker in front of her friends. So I say no. Pooh orders a lime juice. I think that's what they drink. I think that's what they drink, but I can't remember. The waiter brings her a lime juice and we start talking. I don't even know how we start. It's so subtle. We're just talking and it's taking longer than she spent with anybody else. I noticed that. Things are going good. First, she asked me what I do. I say I make music. Mostly, I make opera. She wants to know what the opera is about. Boy, this is hard. I say that they are about people telling stories and that most of the stories are about people I know. She smiles and breaks my heart and says, "That's nice. I would like to hear one sometime." This is very different from the operas in her country, which are all about the gods who invented people and made them bad or good. Actually, I don't much like the operas from her country. I've heard those stories too many times, and I don't believe them, but I wouldn't say this to her. Maybe she doesn't like them either. She's awfully smart. She might like one of my operas. I say something about sending her a recording of one of the operas, but I'm thinking at the same time that if the censors listen to one of my operas, that might get her in trouble. She asked me straight out, "Why do you do that?" What's the answer to that question? I say, because there are so many bad operas, and if I'm going to hear something I like, I have to write it myself. She smiles and breaks my heart. I think she understands what I'm not saying so well, and something strange happens when I'm talking. She starts humming little tunes. Tunes I think I recognize, and her accent changes ever so slightly. I think it's country American. Whoa, she knows something that I hardly know myself. A friend of mine once said to me after a performance, "I didn't know you spoke with a southern accent." I said, "Only when I'm thinking southern thoughts." Family, you know. So I let it out a little bit more and she's matching me. We're starting to sound like Tammy and George. She can really do it. And then I have a hunch. I'll find out what she reads. This is too American. She's testing me and telling me at the same time. Mystery novels, my secret life. I say a famous line. She says the famous answer. My head is swimming. She knows country music and she reads mystery novels. I find out all about this later, but for right now I know why I keep hearing all those guitar chords and thinking all those famous lines. I thought it was the vodka, or maybe I was getting homesick. We keep talking like this, and before I notice and can get control of myself, I am doing all the talking. She's just smiling, and I'm talking like this is the last chance I will ever get to talk to anybody in the world. I'm just talking. The old man with the white hair, wearing a sweater, not a t-shirt, double vodka, talking. Maybe it's the sweater. If I was wearing a t-shirt, she wouldn't be around for long. But she's bundled up and I'm wearing a sweater, so it's like the two of us have something going, something unusual, I hope. I invite her to come to America. I mean New York. She can stay with us and I will be her tour guide for New York. I don't know much about New York because I live there, so we can explore New York together. She says she can't ever come because the visa would cost her $10,000. This is unbelievable. I imagine that I will do something about this when I get home, but I know I won't, because I'm not one of those people who can do anything about anything. I'm beginning to get an idea, and I don't know what the idea is. I asked her if she has ever been out of her country. She said she went to Switzerland a few years ago for a tour guide convention, but she only went because Switzerland is near Paris and she had always wanted to go to Paris. As soon as the convention got to Switzerland, she got on a train to Paris. I asked her how she liked Paris. She said, I never left the hotel room because it was too cold to go out. I guess nobody ratted on her for missing the convention. How did I get into this? Talking about me, I tell her that when I was a kid, which is 30 years before she was even born, I went to Bible school every summer. I told her that Bible school is not actually about teaching kids about the Bible. It's about where to put your kids in the summertime when there's no school while the parents are at work. When I went to Bible school, I was told that in the Bible, that is the New Testament, which she's probably heard about, so I don't explain. The text is mostly in Greek, and in Greek there are three words for love. One is the word that has to do with sex. That's probably eros. Another one, I think, is agape, which is the love for everybody and everything in general. I don't even know what I'm talking about. I'm trying to remember these words from 65 years ago, but agape is probably something like in Buddhism, where everybody in the world is just right in spite of what it looks like. I mean, everything is perfect. She looks at me sort of strange. I don't know what that means. So I just keep on talking. The third word I can't even remember. The third word I can't even remember, the Greek, but it means loving something you can never have. You can see it, and maybe you can touch it, and maybe you can talk to it, but you can never have it. She just smiles. Wow, she just smiles. So I go over it again. You can see it, but you can't have it. By now, I've talked myself into a coma or whatever that condition is when you're out and you just keep talking. Maybe there was another vodka in there somewhere. God, I went over the rice culture, wheat culture, corn culture theory because I think she's rice culture and I know I'm corn culture. I know I'm corn culture. I'll leave that part out here, except the fact that corn cultures have never lasted more than 700 years. So this means the U.S. has about 200 years left. That figures. When I talk like this at home, which happens in spite of myself when the vodka is working, my wife goes in the bedroom and watches TV. Pooh just sits there smiling. I think I'm making a big hit. Actually, I think later I suspect she's trying to figure out whether she can trust me. About this time, the boat docks at some village where the people make pottery. They've been eating rice and making pottery here since the beginning of time. Finally, I can stop talking. Phew. We go ashore on a line of planks laid on the mud, and everybody starts watching people making pottery. I'm still watching Pooh. She doesn't seem too interested in explaining the making of pottery. What's to explain? She's still all bundled up in sweaters and scarves. Once or twice I catch her looking at me. I'm slightly embarrassed by the lecture on everything I know, but something is getting to me that I might understand. If I could have a couple of more vodkas, something is going on here, or something just went on. I have passed some kind of test. Pooh and I have a future together involving my occupation, and I don't mean music. This is very mysterious. Oh well, the journey is far from over.